So Luke chapter 2, starting in verse 39, and reading through the end of the chapter, verse 52. And when they had performed everything according to the law of the Lord, they returned into Galilee to their own town of Nazareth. And the child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up according to custom. And when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, but his parents did not know it. But supposing him to be in the group, they went a day's journey, but then they began to search for him among their relatives and acquaintances. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem searching for him. And after 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and answers. And when they, or his parents, saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I have been searching for you in great distress." And he said to them, "Why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be in my father's house or above my father's business?" They did not understand the saying that he spoke to them. He went down with them and came to Nazareth and was submissive to them. And his mother treasured up all these things in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. A great story. And this is really the only story we have of Jesus when he was young. We don't have it in Matthew, Mark, and John, but we have it in Luke. And so that's why I think it's... this might be pointing to that Luke interviewed Mary and probably got this information from Mary. He, you know, remember, writing to Theophilus, he said he followed all things closely for some time to write an orderly account to Theophilus. So that's part of this orderly account, probably going to some of these resources like Mary. And so we see here in verses 39 through 52 an amazing child. Now John MacArthur gives some examples of amazing children over the centuries, and I'll give you two or three of them. Michael Gross was born in 1954. He was the son of a credit union manager in Lansing, Michigan. He astounded his mother by reading aloud to her without any previous instruction. His IQ was so high he couldn't even be measured. Sounds like me. No, I'm just... Why are you laughing? He was obviously under-challenged at school. At 4 on his first day of kindergarten, he saw a classmate coloring an apple blue. He remarked with interest, "That's the kind of approach Picasso would take." What 4-year-old knows anything about Picasso? At 10, he moved directly from the 5th grade to Michigan State University. He became the youngest college freshman in nearly a century, graduated with a PhD finally from Yale before he was 20. It does, doesn't it? All right. Many believe the most brilliant child prodigy alive today is Kim Ung-young, born in 1963 in Korea. So 63 was a great year for kids to be born. Amazing person. He was talking at 5 months. Writing at 7 months, his IQ is estimated higher than any. When he was 4 years old, get this, he was fluent in Korean, English, Japanese, and German. He was solving intricate calculus problems on Japanese television before his 5th birthday. Wow. Then there was Joe Hall, born in 1966 in Plum Tree, North Carolina. Okay. Son of a high school band director. Surprised his mother by copying the alphabet when he was only 14 months old. This is crazy. At 3, he read adult books on space and electronics. At 5, he was playing the classics on the piano and composing. Stunned parents discovered that he had leukemia, however. So he read about it. And the child remarked, "I suppose my statistical chances don't look too promising." This kid's 5. And he would know his intellectual curiosity undimmed. The boy struggled determinedly against this disease. At 6, he became a pianist with the high school bands. He won a countrywide contest with his compositions. bored with school, you think? With his IQ off the charts, exhausting the resources of the local library, he read in 3 weeks, now get this, he read in 3 weeks, 400 pounds of technical material donated by the Army. It's one way to get rid of their stuff, I guess. At 10, he corresponded with rocket scientist Wernher von Braun. And this is what cracks me up. Set up his own center for UFO investigation. Anyway, amazing, amazing children. But, MacArthur remarks, but for all of these children, they fade into foolishness with one 12-year-old boy named Jesus. The child who was God. In a dramatic and moving account of the one recorded incident in the first 30 years of Jesus' life, Luke gives us a glimpse of the child who was God. No human genius, no IQ immeasurably in excess of the number 200 could even come close to the mind and the capability of the child who was God. I love that introduction by MacArthur. In regards to this 12-year-old boy, this is what they... some of the infant recordings, you know, of Jesus from 0 to 12. This is the only place we have it. But we're going to see in these few verses that Jesus was indeed fully God and fully man. Fully God and fully man. You know, a lot of people, there's some people say, well, he wasn't God until he was 12, or he wasn't God, or God didn't come upon him until he was 30 and was baptized by John. I'm not sure where they get that information, but when you read Luke's account, you begin to say, oh, he's always been God. Why, if it took that long, why would the shepherds come and bow down to him? Why would the wise men come and bow down and offer gifts to him if he was not God at birth?
Why would the angel come and speak to Mary?
Exactly. Why would all that take place? If it's true what some of these theologians say, that he didn't become God until he was 30, something should have happened differently at the baptism of Jesus. None of this prior stuff to his baptism would have taken place if he was not God in the flesh at birth. Paul tells us in Philippians chapter 2 that we are to have our minds as the same as Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not equality with God a thing to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the form of a servant, fully God, fully man. So not only did Paul say it in Philippians, Luke records it in his gospel. So you can take full confidence in the Word of God that this infant to 12-year-old that we're going to talk about today was indeed God in the flesh. Far, incomparably, far beyond some of these whiz kids that we read about just a little bit ago. It's amazing that Jesus was both God and man at birth, and he knew it. For sure. He knew it. And so when it says in the book of Hebrews that he knew the temptation yet was out without sin, included these 12 years, anywhere really from infancy to 30 years old, he was without sin. Tempted in every way that we are. Lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, and the boastful pride of life. I mean, think about this. Put yourself in Jesus' sandals right here. You know you're fully God and fully man. Think about some of the things you could have done when you're faced with all these temptations. But he never sinned. But two time periods show that Jesus is indeed God. We look here at, first of all, in verses 39 and 40, when we're looking at kind of 0 to 12. And verse 39 is looking back to when they presented Jesus at the temple before Simeon and Anna. Okay, so, and when they had performed everything according to the law of Moses or the law of the Lord, everything that, you know, presenting him before to be circumcised and to present him and to dedicate him to the Lord, to pay the shekels, the price of a firstborn child, the temple tax that they were required to do. When they had done all of this kind of thing, they went back to Galilee, to their own town of Nazareth. What's missing in Luke's account here? From the time they finished to the time they went back to Nazareth, something else has happened. It's not recorded here. It's recorded somewhere else. What? Yeah, it went to Egypt. Who was alive at this particular time when he had to go to Egypt? Herod. What did Herod do when he found out that there was another king in the land? What did he do? From 0 to 2 years old, kill all of them. But they had flown to Egypt. And so we don't have the fleeing to Egypt. We don't have the brutality of Herod. We don't have them coming back into out of Egypt to go to Nazareth. So we see that there's something gone there. So you're like, well, why not? Why is this not recorded by Luke, who did such a tremendous job of recording? Well, the reason I believe it is, remember who his audience is. Theophilus. Theophilus probably would get more confused with this. Why did, you know, the Old Testament stuff, as we look at it, why would he do all that? So he probably discounts that or doesn't include it, because that would add further maybe confusion to Theophilus. I'm not exactly sure, but since Theophilus was Greek, probably didn't have a real working knowledge of all the prophecies of the Jews, this wouldn't have helped him. Since this is a personal letter and not a wide distributed letter by Luke, the gospel writer. So most likely it's because Theophilus, it wouldn't have really helped his case at all. Or he would have had to further expand his explanation of why this all happened, and our gospel would have been a whole lot longer than it is now. Probably would have been as big as this book right here. That would have been the Gospel of Luke if he would have tried to explain all the intricate Jewish details and laws to Theophilus so that he understood why they left Bethlehem because of the edict of Herod and had to go to Egypt, and how that fulfilled that particular prophecy, and then he went back here to fulfill that particular prophecy. And that would have been confusing, I think, more than helpful at that time. And in fact, if we read it, you know, we have the privilege and the opportunity to look back and really dissect all those prophecies and looking at the four Gospels. And probably Theophilus didn't have Matthew and Mark, or maybe he did. He already knew that. Okay, that's just kind of hearsay or kind of conjecture. So, all we know is that all of this did take place, and when they returned to their own town of Nazareth, the child grew and become strong, filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. Interesting sentence. If you look back at chapter 1 and verse 80, it says closely the same thing. And the child grew and became strong in spirit, and he was in the wilderness until the day of his public appearance in Israel. Who's it talking about there? John the Baptist. So hark, it says pretty much the same thing about Jesus, but to a greater level. Okay, to a greater level. He became strong, filled with wisdom. So we know that, humanly speaking, Jesus Christ grew up the same way that most normal Jewish boys grew, physically. Jesus probably wasn't 6'4" and you know, brown hair, blue eyes, and product in his hair. He probably was about 5'3". I mean, that's how he was portrayed, you know. He's probably the same height and weight and everything of a first century Jewish man. And so it was his character that made him stand out, not his physical appearance. Normally, when you see a movie about Jesus, you always know who Jesus is, right? He always seems to be taller and American. And with an English accent. It's always greater if they have an English accent. It just sounds cooler. But he grew up the same way that you and I do, but he was filled with wisdom. not only the he was filled with it to overabundance, in a sense, he knew that which he needed to be taught. His, you know, his brain wasn't this big when he was born. He was an infant, as helpless physically as you and I were, same size brain, all that kind of thing. And he had to grow physically and intellectually, yet at the same time knowing who he was. So he grew as any human child would grow. And the favor of God was upon him. I love that. That's the word we get grace again. The spiritual blessing. They knew just by the way he carried himself. They knew that he was a carrier of grace, not a recipient of grace. That grace, the grace of God, or the spiritual blessing of God, was upon him. So that he knew it, so that he really was above sin. Even though, again, he was tempted in every way in which we were, yet without sin, even at this age, and I'm still amazed how God uses young people. If you think about it, in our society, it was interesting to me that I was like 28 years old. And that was, what, 20 years ago or whatever? Not that long ago. I'm 48 now, 28 years. That's okay, 48 minus 28. How much, Annie? 20. Sharp, aren't I? At IQ? Okay. But it was interesting how people would ask me, now, what do you do? I'm in my 20s, early 30s, right? I tell them, I'm a pastor, a minister. You're awful young. What does that mean? Yeah, I mean, you think about this, and then I start whirling through my head all these people that God used at a really young age. And I think about, well, number one, extra biblical would be Charles Spurgeon. 19 years old, he's preaching to a congregation of over 12,000 people. 19 years old. It's pretty fascinating to me. But then I think about Old Testament characters, youth, who are we talking about on Wednesday night? And how old was he? Probably about 14 years old. And he's facing the most powerful man in the world. That's about ready to tear him limb from limb. Then you think about Jeremiah, who was a teenager when he was called to be a prophet. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were about the same age in the book of Daniel. John the Apostle, they say, was probably 16 or 17 years old when Jesus called him to himself. So here is all these people that were very young being used of God to proclaim the glory of God. And now we see here the glory of God walks upon the earth. And he's in the single digits here. Very young. So he became strong physically, mentally, emotionally. He's filled with wisdom, probably far beyond what you and I are capable of, far beyond these, you know, people that I read about earlier. But the favor of God, or the grace of God, was upon me. See that again in verse 52. So this is the glimpse that we get so far from the age of infancy to 12, who we're about ready to meet, which I think is just a fascinating time. So we see that this child grew, became strong, far more than anything that we could ever imagine. Now, verse 41 is very interesting. You think, well, why? Now, his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the Feast of the Passover. Why do I find that interesting? Number one, it's every year. They had to leave and go 80 miles from where they were. The second thing is really kind of captivates you is because normally it was just the men who would go. The women would go once in a while, but the men would go every year. Well, we kind of understand and figure out why probably the men would go when the women always wouldn't. Maybe they were pregnant. Maybe they were, you know, newborn infants, so on and so forth. That might have prevented them from going. But every year it says here that both his parents, both Joseph and Mary, would go. We think also of back in Samuel's time, that when they would go to Jerusalem, Hannah didn't always go. with her husband Elkanah because she was raising Samuel and going to wean him and then present him before the Lord. So she, not only as godly as Hannah was, went every year like Mary did here. So this is pretty interesting that men went every year, but women, what it showed really, if the women would go every year, how godly the women were. But I think it also, in the life of Jesus, Mary knew in her heart of hearts who he was and what he'd come to do. So she's going to go up every year. Because, you know, we look back at the calling when she was probably around 13 years old and Gabriel coming to her and saying that she was indeed blessed among women. Blessed is the fruit of your womb. And you would think that that would really cause a change in her life, a real eternal perspective, and now she would go every year with her husband Joseph. So not only did she know who Jesus was, she was a diligent wife as well to Joseph. So we also, it kind of tells you what kind of man Joseph was. You know, it's interesting. Normally, when you see Mary and Joseph, how old is Mary? When we get a picture, how old is Mary? About 13, right? How old is Joseph a lot of times? Like 25, 40. He was probably a teenager too. I mean, he probably wasn't very old. Okay? I mean, we don't know what happens to Joseph. Joseph's not in the picture, the reason being, because the focus is on Jesus. Okay? But he probably wasn't a lot older than Mary, if older than Mary. Probably a little bit, but not in his 20s or 40s. I'm not sure why they do that, but that's kind of the way we look at it. So, when he was 12 years old, he went up according to custom. In other words, he followed his parents, went up to the Passover, but a custom here. This was before the time of, you know, nowadays the Jewish people, when they hit, the boys hit 13, they have what is called a bar mitzvah. This was before this all happened. Okay? Bar mitzvahs were not known at this time, according to sources. But when you're 12 years old, the intensity level of the religious instruction grew at quite a rate. This is kind of when they separated the spiritual men from boys. Those who would go on and become part of a rabbi's clan, so to speak, and those who would just go back to fishing or carpentry or whatever. So this is kind of what we look at here. This religious teaching would be more intense for this age here. They really wanted to get the Old Testament scriptures, the law and the prophets and the wisdom or the Psalms and Proverbs into these young men so that they could lead not only their families but the nation later on. So that their nation would remain strong. And they did it even under Roman rule. This is because this is the time of the Roman Empire. So at 12 years old, he goes up, according to custom, when the feast ended, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. And his parents did not know it. Were these irresponsible parents? No, because again, at 12 years old, the guy was pretty much an adult. Okay? He was apprenticing with his daddy, carpenter, and the religious instruction was up, you're responsible enough. Now, you think about this and think about our society today. Would you want a 12-year-old driving your car? No. I understand. I think about that. But these people, fortunately, they didn't have cars back then, but this young man now at 12 years old was sort of considered an adult. So supposing in verse 44 to him to be in the group, they went a day's journey. They began to search for him among their relatives and acquaintances. So apparently what was going on is that they would go back with their family, extended family. Okay? So he's probably hanging out with one of his buddies, Joe or whatever, Jesus with Joe. So we're good. But when he didn't report in for dinner or whatever, they became a little concerned. So they go back and they begin to search for him. Now, I haven't seen him. Last time I saw him, he was in the temple. Okay, so they have to go back to Jerusalem. You know they're thrilled about this, right? Okay. So it was like, it must have been similar to when we lived in Georgia, and Heidi, I don't know where Heidi's at. She's at a meeting or something, and I grab Rachel and Caleb, and I get home, and I'm looking around, I'm like, where's CJ?
Be in
a store. No, at a ballpark. She probably left you at the store. I don't know. I go back. I'm like, oh, shoot. So I drive back real quick, because it's at night in Georgia. And I get back there, and he's just playing in the field, baseball or whatever. I'm like, whew. So yeah, I mean, he wasn't coming home with a family. He would have been there all night if I wouldn't have figured out he was, where's the redheaded kid at? I've experienced probably what the feeling is of these parents forgetting their child. I still love you, CJ. Can't forget you now. You're bigger than I am. Yeah. We did another person, too, in our family. So both of us, Heidi and I, have experienced that. So they go look for him among their relatives and acquaintances. They didn't find him. Returned to Jerusalem searching for him. Verse 46 is huge. Where did they find him? Look what he's doing. Sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking questions. And all who were, heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. So not only was he asking questions, he was answering questions that they may have of him. They were stunned that this young 12-year-old would know the things he knew about God. Which brings out a good point. We underestimate what our young people can understand and do for God. I think we really do. They're not afraid to tell people about Jesus. We seem to be afraid. They can memorize Scripture far better than you and I can. They really can. We think about it too much. They say that a child can do a Rubik's Cube faster or easier or quicker than an adult. Because they just do it. We sit there and think about it, and then I take the stickers off and switch the stickers. Okay? Because of my high IQ. Okay. So, work smarter, not harder. But these young people, I believe these young people can really understand the deep things of God. They sort of expected the 12-year-old to, but not at the level that Jesus did. Because not only was he asking questions, he was probably teaching them at 12 years old. So they're stunned at this young man knowing the Word of God. I don't think it was just by osmosis. I think he was really engaged with his father at a young age, talking to him, listening to him, but also his earthly father, Joseph, and Mary, his mother. He was listening to what they were teaching. And they were not afraid to share that which they knew of God and would share it with him. And I think a lot of times, and my huge mistake as a father and as a husband, is that assuming that what I do, especially as a pastor, whether I'm reading or teaching or whatever, that it's just going to somehow magically flow to my wife and my children, they'll just pick it up and get it and run with it. That doesn't happen. It's good that you ask children questions. It's good for them to ask questions and put you on the spot. Caleb was always good at doing that. CJ's pretty good at doing it. And they'll ask you a question, you're standing there going, thinking to yourself, how do I answer this? Like Caleb asked just a few years ago, a real simple question. How do we trust God? Think about it. The context there was that, we know where our income's going to come. We know that we're going to get paid on Friday or whatever the case may be. And we know that our insurance is going to be paid by the company or, you're going to have enough money. All these kind of things. How do we trust God? What area do we trust God? Some of those questions are pretty insightful. And to know, as a parent, to know this Bible is very, very important. So that when some of these questions do come up, you have answers. Not that you're going to have an answer to every question. I think that would be impossible. But be prepared. But also, do not underestimate that your young people, they are picking up. They are picking up what you're laying down, so to speak. Because more is caught than taught. They are very observant. And did you know, most, if not all, teenagers know when you're a fake. You can sound real sincere and all, but they know. They can look right through you and know that you're fake. It is very true in regards to teenagers that they don't care how much you know. You know what the rest of it is, right? Until they know how much you care. That's really important. So not only know God, but be real with God. And you don't want to come up with a lot of things. If you know the Word of God, but you're not living the Word of God, they can see that, they can recognize it, and they'll just blow you off. So it's very important that we as believers, as adults, don't underestimate the young people, and that we challenge the young people. And that is something that I, you know, if I had to do it all over again, and if I knew then what I know now, it would be a different story, right? So here this Jesus says, and they're amazed at his understanding and answers. Like, you were amazed when I read these, right? Infinitely greater than that is what Jesus knew. That he amazed even the experts. And he's going to amaze the whole world at one time. So the parents see him, they're astonished. Why have you treated us so? So your father and I have been searching for you in great distress. So Mary's a good mother, right? So and apparently Joseph is a very good father because he was also in great distress. And Jesus says something stunning in verse 49. Well, why were you looking? This is not belligerent. This is not confronting them and challenging their authority. It's more like, oh, why are we looking for me? Did you not know this is who I am? Did you not know that I must be in my father's house? And if he's in his father's house, he's about his father's business. Why does this surprise you? In other words, instead of 3 days, their first motion when they couldn't find him in the group, I know where he's at. He's in the temple. Let's go there. They didn't have to go through Jerusalem like they did 3 days and then find him. Hey, Mary, I know where he's at. Exact where he's at. Joseph, I do too. Let's go there. Because we know whom Gabriel said that he would be. We know who Zechariah said that he would be. We should know that he's in his father's house. But they just couldn't quite get it because it wasn't time for them. But look back. What does Jesus say? Did you not know that I must be in my father's house? That was really almost a earth-shaking statement.
It's his father's house.
It's intimacy as well. There's an intimacy there. Because later on, Jesus says to his disciples, not my father only, but yours also. My father, your father. There's that intimacy that Christ has with his Father, which shows the intimacy that Christ has with us and that the Father has with us as well. There's that relationship there between Father and Son. So this is a tremendous earth-shattering statement here in regards to the intimacy that God the Father and God the Son have, not only with one another, but with us as well. He's setting an example. He's laying it down. Look at the intimacy. Look at how the shape of things to come, so to speak, that the veil is going to be torn. One day the veil will be torn and you have direct access to the Father. This is really kind of a groundbreaking for this particular idea of knowing the intimacy that you and I have the opportunity to have with God the Father through God the Son. That is the grace of God, the sovereign free will of God to show us the intimacy that he can have for us. But they did not understand that. So when they went back to Nazareth and he was with them, he was submissive to them as a good son ought to be. Another great example. So young man, there you are. And his mother, with all this treasure up, all these things, everything that even though she was in great distress,
not where he was, but finding him in the temple, she treasured that in her heart as well. And maybe even that statement of, I must be about my father's business, or don't you know I'll be in my father's house? She treasured that up in her heart as well. And Jesus increased in wisdom, in stature, or years, and in favor or spiritual blessing with God and man. So this is from the ages of 12 to 30 there, verse 52. Just prior to his public appearance, through the baptism of John the Baptist, and coming on the scene, this is what we know about God. Not much, but it's powerful stuff. Showing us his humanity, showing us his divinity, showing us the intimacy that he had with his Father, and that we can have with his Father, and with him. That's the grace of God.